National Archives podcast series, Engineering Office Staff, presented by Tim Proctor as part of the Railways Change Lives Conference.
I'd like to start with a quote that some of you may recognise. There was a feeling of urgency about the locomotive side, an alacrity, enthusiasm for getting on with things as one design of engine was finished and the decks were cleared for the next. Everyone strove to do his best, for the chief had inspired a sense of teamwork in which all participated under his leadership. That's taken from the first volume of Harold Holcroft's Locomotive Adventure. It's his impression of the atmosphere in the Swindon drawing offices under G.J. Churchwood in 1906. As Ed mentioned, some years ago I began to look at the processes and management of railway drawing offices as part of the annual Big Draw campaign. And that had been inspired by my work at Birmingham on the Bolton and Watt archive. Bolton and Watt are obviously well known as their stationary steam engines powered the Industrial Revolution, and James Watt's technical advances are well known. But their skill in production management is slightly less well known. Their drawing office was actually the epicentre of their organisation. It didn't just produce drawings. It controlled the whole system of their production of engines. It managed their ordering processes. It issued the instructions to their field engineers. And indeed, when not out in the field working on engines, those engineers were actually required to work in the drawing office. And I got to piece together all of the surviving records from the drawing office that showed how the business actually worked. But the remarkable thing about those records was the amount of personal stories and commentary on what was going on at the time that came out from what on the surface were just routine business and technical records. The lives of Bolton and Watt's drawing office staff and the engineers who came through this office were touched, among other things, by family migration, by dishonourable military discharge, depression, drinking, womanising, debt and bare-knuckle boxing. And there's also a love of music that comes out, providing for their children, and the odd act of outstanding heroism and selflessness. Also revealed in these archives are their personal friendships, several personal animosities and feuds, so that you began to get a sense of the atmosphere of the drawing office and who would or would not work with whom. And again, the striking thing about this is that none of these stories came from personal papers or diaries or obituaries or later reminiscences. They were all revealed from the company record. Can we begin to answer the question, what is it like working in a railway office? And the example quote from Holcroft illustrates some of the frustrations. Even though that quote is from an unofficial and ostensibly a very personal source, it still carries that sense of traditional railway awe and veneration, the sense that the drawing office was precise and efficient and functional and driven. And both Holcroft's book and the other big well-known memoir of an engineer who was office-based, Edgar J. Larkin's Memoirs of a Locomotive Engineer, they both omit that personal side and they both concentrate on the technicalities and the locomotive work they're doing. In fact, Holcroft mentions at one point that he and the Swindon Works manager like to pass long winter afternoons designing their own types of locomotive. It's almost a monkish atmosphere and a real sort of worship of the technical that's conjured up. Now, we do know that Robson survived the war, if I don't think he served at the front at all. But looking on the NRM's database of railway employees who did die, there are no fewer than 20 North Eastern Railway men with the surname of Robson who are listed as killed, including one from Darlington and several from the wider Tyne area. Now, I was not so naive as to expect that I was easily going to uncover a plethora of intriguing, exciting life stories from the railway archives as easily as I had done with Bolton and Watt. For a start, just the nature of the archives mitigate against it. Railway archives are huge and dispersed between places like ourselves, the National Archives, and the local authority record office network. Bolton and Watt's archives date from the late 18th and early 19th century, before printed processes and guided forms and printed instructions were so commonplace. So back at that point, there's much more room for personal notes and extra information and revelatory marginalia. By the time you get to the 1920s, the opportunity for personal additions into the business record has almost disappeared. I'm going to admit now this is a start of a quest for me. It's a very incomplete one, and it's a start of a research process. I've had to limit myself to this paper to only a small selection of the records here in the NRM and at the National Archives. So I hope what I'm talking about today might generate some more research and investigation and start to bring together information and on different cases to perhaps begin to try and build a common picture or some contrasting experiences. So by the 1910s, most railway companies were employing more office and clerical staff than they were train crew, in some cases by considerable margins. As the companies grew through expansion and merger in the late 19th and into the 20th century, not surprisingly, their staff and organisational structures grew far more sophisticated and far more complicated. Some of the London South Western Railway's offices in London housed things like marketing and ticketing operations. By the 1890s, most railway goods departments had expanded so much and most of the railway companies were deriving so much income from mineral traffic that the mineral traffic not only got its own dedicated teams of clerks but also separate offices, separate heads of department. That's the North Eastern's Mineral Audit Office in Doncaster in 1916. And of course, in addition to these functions of running a railway, moving passengers, moving goods, the companies had to develop staff to deal with all the attendant administration that goes with any large private company. So accounting, wages, control of assets, land and property, advertising, infrastructure such as telephones and telegraphs, the list is almost endless. Clerk, as we've heard, becomes the catch-all term for the general office worker in the Victorian period. By the 1890s, railway clerks were numerous enough and beginning to be organised enough to gain their own trade union. There was a great deal of resistance to this union even forming from the railway companies. It starts off life as the National Association of General Railway Clerks and fairly quickly becomes the Railway Clerks Association. It lasts until 1951 when it's absorbed into the Transport Salaried Staffs Association. Now, they had a general history written and the author of that history put the membership numbers in 1904 at 4,000, but he estimated the potential membership, so the number of clerks in the industry, at 60,000. If you move forward into grouping, staff structures are becoming far, far more complicated, and the companies are beginning to develop ways of recording this and categorising it and managing it. One way they'd cope is to divide the company up into several different operating areas. So the North Eastern, for example, divides itself into a North, a Central and a Southern operating division. But there's a very good survival in the National Archives that illustrates just how complicated and how involved a railway company structure had become by the 1930s. And it's an even more interesting document because it begins to bridge the rather impersonal corporate structure world and brings us into the world of the personal office worker. It's a set of organisation charts drawn up by the Great Western Railway. It was typed up in 1929, but it's had various hand additions and corrections that take it through into the early 1930s. And it starts off with the very high-level departmental organisation and then presents a series of very detailed charts that not only name all the office staff, but also list their duties and their areas of responsibility. And that's something you don't get in so much detail from the standard staff registers. I don't know if anyone in the audience remembers a series of books in the 1970s called What Do People Do All Day? They were by an American author called Richard Scarry, who designed, obviously, to introduce primary-age children to the concept of work. And this volume could have been produced with just that question in mind. And almost as an added bonus, you get breakdowns of the staff, so data analysing the number of women, the various grades, and that sort of thing. As well as all this attendant administration, the chief mechanical engineers and the other company engineers are also expanding their roles. So by this point, the chief mechanical engineer has got under his control, obviously, the drawing office, but also a group of general offices, mileage and statistics office, separate wages offices for both locomotive and carriage and wagon staff, and no fewer than five separate accounts offices. Getting to grips with railway records involves an awful lot of ploughing through masses of detail. But once you get to grips with this detail, it starts to invite you to create a personal view of the office. A lot of railway office work is very routine, very repetitive, driven by a veritable battery of forms and procedures and submissions of information. And that's true no matter which office you're in, which company you're working for, or which department. Attention to detail is absolutely crucial. And sometimes the staff will produce their own handbooks of how to do their job. A chap called E.C.K. Rogers, who worked in the LMS commercial offices, produces an incredibly detailed manual to how to do his job. He sticks in the various forms he has to fill in with instructions to himself about what to do. His instructions show that he's dependent on information from other clerks, so he's getting coal and coke figures from mineral clerks, cattle information from weekly return clerks, and so on. So these guys don't work in isolation, and there's this whole complex web of information and statistics just moving around the company that's being supplied from stations and depots to offices to headquarters, and then more returns are requested. And to modern computerised processes, this must seem arcane and alien and possibly quite stultifying. Alfred Williams, our man from Swindon, hints that sometimes this sort of work actually wasn't all that well regarded. He says, "The clerks are the most numerous of all the trained classes at the factory. With the draftsmen, they form an imposing body, yet though they rank next to the foremen and the heads of departments, they are not taken very seriously by the rank and file, except when they appear in the sheds with the cash box to pay the weekly wages." As we've heard, to enter a railway works, a railway staff structure, was to enter a highly disciplined and highly regulated organisation. Dye mentioned the company rule books, and some company offices went even further than the rule book and produced their own volumes of regulations. Rules include things like: the drawing offices are to be kept strictly private. No persons except those in the company's service having business there are to be allowed in. Contractors and others calling on business are to be seen in the room provided for the purpose. In no case are they to be taken into the drawing office. No outdoor expenses will be allowed for half a day's work. So, highly regulated and quite strict working atmosphere. We also can get an impression of what the companies considered ideal office accommodation, certainly at least as far as drawing offices go. Just occasionally in the proceedings of the Institute of Locomotive Engineers, a paper on drawing offices would be presented. There's a very useful one in 1938 from a chap called Appleyard, who obviously came from the private locomotive manufacturing sector, and he made lots of recommendations for how you set up a drawing office. He was talking about north-facing, so you don't get awkward sunfall, you have plenty of artificial light, you give each draftsman 9 foot of space for their drawing boards. One thing he doesn't talk about, though, are things like toilets, wash basins, refreshments. But sometimes drawings do survive that allow us to gauge whether the companies were putting this into practice, although, again, they're quite rare. The company's official photographic record can also give us a clue about what life in a railway office was like, but not always in the way they intended. The big offices and the administrative offices just aren't photographed that much. I've so far failed to find a photograph of a carriage and wagon drawing office that actually shows the staff at work. The staff records at the National Archives are probably the most high-profile surviving railway archives, and those of you who've researched in them will know their survival is by no means complete, and the amount of information you get from company to company and register to register varies greatly, and obviously the work that Ancestry are doing, putting these online, makes them much more accessible now, and they can obviously yield a wealth of information for the genealogist. A chap called Sid Lloyd Baister, and this is Stratford Works, started his career with the North Eastern as an apprentice and joins the Great Eastern and rises to become Stratford Works manager with the LNER in 1928. But can this sort of record help us to build up a more communal picture? Again, this is where I'm getting probably most exploratory and speculative in my talk so far, but as I say, there's much more research to do. It's clear, though, that when people misbehave or things go wrong, that's when you get more detail. A very striking entry I found in the Great Northern Railway's Locomotive Department Office Staff Register. George Henry Barlow was suspended for 6 days on the 25th of February 1907 for misconduct in the mileage office during working hours. Later on, he leaves the company in 1908 when his services are no longer required due to a reduction of staff. You do wonder if this had counted against him. Quite possibly it had. But what makes this a bit more intriguing is that another clerk, Alfred George Challenger, was also suspended for 6 days for the exact same misconduct. Challenger had a prior reprimand. So what were they up to? Was the mileage office a hotbed of corruption? Had they engaged in some horrendous practical joke that had gone wrong? Unfortunately, the register doesn't tell us. It'd be interesting to try and find out. But as I look through the staff records, where the ones that do note reprimands and punishments, examples of crime or really serious wrongdoing are extremely rare. There's a Cheshire Lines Committee staff irregularities register from 1915 to 1926, and it's full of errors by shunters and drivers endangering the life of passengers. There are no examples in there of clerks being brought before the committee or the board for misconduct. Far more common is this sort of lower grade misconduct. Again, from the Great Northern Register, this is a clerk called Arthur Moat, who was suspended for 3 days for carelessness in checking pay sheets, which is quite a harsh punishment, losing 3 days' pay. I think if I was suspended for 3 days for carelessness in checking emails, I'd probably never be at work. Another clerk, Robert Smith, who was reprimanded again for carelessness, making incorrect entries in the general office pay sheet. And as you go through the register, the frequency of these reprimands, it shows us that the office work was repetitive and it was very dependent on attention to detail, but also that mistakes were not taken lightly. And you begin to build up a picture of particular teams being blighted by sloppy work of more than one clerk. And again, Alfred Williams touches on this as a problem at Swindon. And he says the problem was down to the chief clerks or the office heads. And he wrote, "A great deal depends upon the temper and the honesty or dishonesty of the overseer. If he's honourable and above board, he will not tolerate any covert dealings and tale-bearing. If, on the other hand, he is shifty and cunning, he will encourage all kinds of slimness and questionable proceedings on the part of his clerks. Unfortunately, he doesn't then go on to say which offices were the real problems." But we can, again, go back to the official record to find more examples. I also looked at the Midland Railway's Locomotive Department Staff Register, which is about the same period as the Great Northern one. And again, it lists the careers of supervisors, draftsmen, clerks, and other attendant staff like photographers, cooks and messengers. And unusually, this volume starts to bring some detail in that begins to colour in the domestic life of some of these clerks and draftsmen. And some of them clearly have rather troubled lives. William Nichols Stentiford was arrested in March 1900 for owing 8 weeks arrears of maintenance payments to his wife. He says that his wife was constantly bullying him, so there's obviously quite a turbulent domestic situation here. There's also another entry for a clerk called Frank Ball, who has his wages reduced and is dismissed in 1890 because of drinking. Now, he's re-employed at Derby, but only on the condition that he takes a temperance pledge. And the volume notes they're only taking him back out of consideration for the fact that his father was a Midland Railway employee as well. His father had actually died on company service in 1875. So again, the domestic situation straying into the workplace. Generally, the draftsmen are pretty blameless and spotless, but when they do go awry, they really do it in spectacular fashion. A draftsman called Thomas Reginald Hatton, who joined the Derby Drawing Office in March 1899, he's dismissed on the spot only 7 months later, and the company prepared to pay him a week's pay in lieu of notice to get him off the premises. Now, the compiler of the staff register seems to have taken great delight in recording his subsequent career. In November 1902, he's sentenced to 9 months' hard labour, having pleaded guilty to 3 counts of obtaining money by false pretences. He's arrested in Manchester in the offices of the Westinghouse Company, a railway signalling and braking supply company. The police are actually informed of his whereabouts by Westinghouse's office manager. He's convicted for several offences around the country. But very, very occasionally, working in the Midland Railway offices seems to have actually been the makings of a man. A chap called John Channon joins the Midland as a cleaner at Leicester in 1876 and becomes a timekeeper. He's suspended for irregular conduct. He then goes back to Leicester, where he's further disciplined for irregular conduct, and he's demoted to labourer for leaving his duties and going off drinking. He resigns, moves to Rugby, he's dismissed again for being drunk on duty, and he pitches up at Derby in February 1885. And again, as with the case of the previous clerk, he's given a second chance. Surprisingly, they don't make him take the temperance pledge. But joining the office at Derby, he then spends 17 calm, trouble-free years and rises to become the head of locomotive office number one. So obviously something about the atmosphere at Derby kept him in line. He retires in 1902 and pretty soon he's back to his old ways. He's pulled up before the magistrates for disorderly conduct in 1905 and was obviously considered still to be a slur on the company because the Midland threatened to cut his pension off if he repeats again. So if we begin to compare these two registers, the Midland and the Great Northern, which are covering similar departments, similar time periods, we get a slightly contrasting picture. What's going on at Derby? It's not mistakes and sloppy, careless work, but there's crime, there's turbulent personal lives, and there's lots of second chances. So can we start to conclude that the atmosphere at Derby was different? Was it a bit more raw? Were the Midland a little more welcoming in their employment policy and prepared to give people second chances? Was the discipline and the work ethic at Doncaster much stronger? Very hard to prove, interesting to speculate. Now, the presence of women in railway offices has also been touched on today. Women were appointed to clerical positions and as tracers in drawing offices from the late 19th century. So by the 1920s, certainly most of the large departmental offices had experience of men and women working together for some time. But the employment of women did bring change to office life, and it is possible to get a sense of that change, again, from some of the official records. At TNA, there's an incredible file from the Great Western, from the company secretary's department, when they're on the verge of starting to appoint women clerks to the big offices. The general manager consults all the office managers to get their reactions for employing women. The main reasons for them employing women are economic. They'll pay them a lower wage and they'll be expected to leave the company when they get married. Most of the office managers, though, object on supposed practical grounds. They cite things like higher sickness levels, declining contributions to the superannuation fund over long periods of time, the lack of suitable jobs. For example, the cash department manager says we can't send women around the network with bags of money. There's also a serious criticism that comes up several times is that employing women means there are a lack of training ground posts for male clerks to rise up the structure. And several of them almost inevitably complain about the expense of providing separate toilets and restrooms. But there are a couple of responses to this survey from the general manager that are a little bit more honest about the effect that they were afraid women were going to have. W. Williams, who's the head of the Surveyors and Estate Office, is probably being quite bold when he suggests, "I have no objection to the introduction of a female clerk to a room of male clerks, provided a senior and responsible clerk is present to see that discipline is preserved." The manager of the registration office is far more worried and clearly worried about contact between men and women going on under his control. He points out that clerks of both sexes will have to go and consult ledgers in the transfer office, and therefore men clerks cannot be prevented from associating with the women clerks. This is a serious objection. But trying to find the reactions of clerks on the ground themselves once women have been introduced is quite hard. Another driver behind my research has been to try and test the fabled camaraderie of the railway office, the view of the railway as benevolent an employer with groups of fellow workers all banded together in things like sports clubs and football teams and allotment associations is all part of that picture of the golden age of railways. Certainly if you immerse yourself in any of the company staff magazines, that'll do nothing to disabuse you of the notion that the railways were offering the very best in paternalistic benevolence. But it must be remembered, the staff magazines, although they really do give an insight into railway life, they are official company records and therefore carry a company bias. That's also a trait shared by some of the more ephemeral official records we have. A couple of menus for official company outings for their staff. And all you can really tell is when the trip was going to happen and where they went. And here we have to acknowledge that the true official record can only help us so far. It can give us hints and enough details to begin to imagine an atmosphere, but really nothing can replace that first-hand account, that personal record, the image of the workplace generated by people who were actually there. And we started this talk with the sort of frustrating lack of personal memoirs. I did find one very good one from Wolverton. It's a very short volume by a former apprentice called Eric Bell Chambers, who started off in the accountant's office. And he writes, "Although it was 1923, the office still had a Dickensian look. True, it was cleaned each day, so there was no sign of dust, and it was light and airy. But the men sat in rows on high stools at long sloping desks, which was mounted by brass solid rails to accommodate their great leather ledgers when these were not in use. As a callow youngster straight from school, I was at first overawed by the place. One did not genuflect, but proper reverence was expected." But if that sort of narrative is few and far between, the NRM archives are fortunate to have some personal records, for want of a better term, that give some insight into the character of certain railway offices, and which do show that railway office camaraderie was a real thing, a genuine spirit, but again, not necessarily in the ways the companies might have appreciated. Occasionally in the register, these little character sketches of former colleagues. This is a chap who'd recently died in 1943, and they affectionately remember him being a football fan. Another thing that the Wolverton Drawing Office staff do in the late 1940s through to the 1970s is embellish the covers of some of the most dull records I think we have in the works archive, the materials in and out books, and whether they're practicing their draftsmanship skills or whether they're whiling away a bored hour or just trying to decorate some rather boring processes that they've got to carry out, we don't know, but these are rather attractive. And this sort of attempt to humanise the repetitive nature of their office work usually seems to go hand in hand with a slightly irreverent attitude towards their employers, and the sense of escape from the company definitely comes through. Perhaps the most insightful record that we have is a volume called The Enginorum. It records the doings of a group of staff in the Great Western Engineers office at Paddington, led by one clerk called H.G. Vincent. It's run like a pseudo-private club. It's got its own mock rules and in-jokes and rituals, and the whole volume is done as per a mock company document, obviously a parody of the work they were having to do. Enginorum is both the clerks as a group themselves and their office. They call it the Land of Enginorum. And a lot of the humour in it, by today's standards, is racially and gender very incorrect. They're obviously using office time and resources for all this larking about, and obviously that probably wouldn't be tolerated today, but it sort of goes back to the point I was making earlier about this desire to humanise the company machine, and they're obviously forging some really close friendships. Two of the clerks go out to join the South African Railways, and their departure is keenly felt. They make an awful lot of jokes about tribal brides and some cannibals waiting for them, but underneath all that is a real sense of some friendships moving on, and lots of postcards come back from South Africa to the team at Paddington. In many other ways, it shows that office life hasn't changed. Football is taken extremely seriously, although they seem to be keen on playing rather than spectating, play matches against other offices and seem to have a rivalry with the superintendent of the lines office. And they produce their own little football newsletter, the Terminus Times. When they take part in other Great Western sports, there's the Great Western's Pelican Swimming Club. They get the programmes, and where they've won, they write their victories in their own hand in quite crowing terms. And there's also a photo that seems to, it's a bit faded, but it seems to show them playing a full-blown cricket match on company time. Not surprisingly as well, drinking is a major theme. They also produce a little series of pen portraits of themselves. A quote from one about the clerk called Jason Berry. Mr. Berry attributes his success in German to the imbibing of large quantities of Munich and Pilsen beer and the steady worship of my lady nicotine. Sobriety, though, does sometimes intrude into all the larking about. As I mentioned, the departure of their two colleagues from South Africa seems to elicit some genuine emotion. And sometimes it's quite hard to know if they're being serious or not. The architect Richard Murphy said in 2012 that post-industrial workplaces have replaced the danger and the stench of factories with the battery chicken world of the office and the call centre. For me, this is the core of the subject, the inhumanity of the workplace. It would drive me bonkers in a week. Well, I don't think Richard Murphy would have lasted very long in a railway office then. And I think you could argue that the battery effect that he's talking about in office process starts a lot before the end of the 20th century. And indeed, you can almost argue that the railway companies are contributing to that process. But as I hope I've shown you today, railway offices were absolutely full of humanity and stories. And I hope I've shown it's possible at least a fraction to open the door on the lives that were contained therein. Thank you.
This talk was recorded on the 14th of September 2013 at the National Railway Museum, York. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.